it's not about the money. I mean, there's one that I read that $2.8 million was awarded for a burn for just general laparoscopic procedure from a medical malpractice case. Another one just talks about the symptoms that usually patients seem to appear or experience normal recovery, which is what I was talking about when I was scrubbing and during the first few days. But however, 3 to 7 days, they have complications like fever and nausea and vomiting. And when they go back in to do exploratory lap to find a cause for that, then it's discovered that they have internal organs that were burned during that procedure.
Every day, they slay the dragons of healthcare-acquired infections and dangerous microbial fire breathers. While you may not see them during your next hospital stay, they will be there, ensuring the safest possible surgeries by skillfully wielding their disinfecting weapons of mass microbial destruction. They are sterile processing professionals, and this is Beyond Clean, the central nexus for the people, processes, and products that are pushing the global sterile processing industry forward. Join us every week as we introduce you to the unsung heroes who are fighting dirty around the globe. And now, it's time to go Beyond Clean.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with Sharon Rojo, SPD Educational Coordinator for Healthmark Industries. Sharon has his CRCST, CIS, CER, CFER, and CHL certifications. He has 28 years in the sterile processing arena as a sterile processing technician, SPD educator, instrument coordinator, and a surgical technologist in the surgical realm. He graduated in 2008 with highest honors from Fresno City College with an Associates of Arts in Speech Communication, specializing in public speaking and team dynamics. He is currently working on his BS in communication. He is currently on the AMI working groups for ST79, PB70, and ST91. Sharon has also taught the CRCST and CIS courses since 2006 for new and existing sterile processing technicians. He has presented to local colleges and at seminars across the country for numerous organizations such as APIC, SGNA, AAMA, AORN, and ISHM with topics related to the periop arena, specializing in effective communication and the struggles of sterile processing today. Sharon is a published author in the AORN Journal and in Surgical Products, and he is a great advocate for nurturing education throughout the United States. We definitely had a lot of acronyms in there, Mike, so if anybody wants to know all of those acronyms, definitely reach out to Beyond Clean and we'll let you know. But what it does say about Sharon is that he's incredibly involved and incredibly knowledgeable, and he's a great communicator if you picked up on his background and his own personal education, and it's really going to shine through in today's podcast.
Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to this one. Justin, you and I have talked about before that in our time as educators, that this particular topic, it just amazes us how many people don't take this seriously. And so this has been a needed topic for us to discuss on the show. And I don't think we could have picked anyone better to talk about it than Sharon.
Nope, I agree, and we'll get into it, but I do want to tell everybody this episode's so critical because it's going to give you what you need if you're not doing insulation testing at your facilities today.
Healthmark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com. There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs. It's 2023 and there's big news for IST. A closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTracks adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for offsite sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
You're listening to Beyond Clean, the global voice of sterile processing.
Joining us now is Sharon Rojo, SPD Educational Coordinator for Healthmark Industries. And Sharon, this topic, near and dear to both Mike and I, we're going to have a great conversation today. And as a matter of fact, as we were talking, just as we were getting ready to do the interview, I said, this is one of those that is just so important. You're almost surprised it's not already secondhand nature, but so many places we have to continue to educate on this, and I'm glad we're going to use the podcast format to really heighten awareness about, and I love Hank's title for this one, Shock Treatment, a conversation on life-saving insulation testing, really critical. So thanks for coming on today.
Oh, thank you for having me, guys. Thank you.
And I know you had an opportunity recently, it'll be a couple of months ago by the time this broadcast, but you had a chance to share this information on a webinar with Becker's, I believe, which is just great because I just see more and more of these topics getting out there for the general population. Maybe talk about that a little bit as we tee up the episode.
Yeah, it was really quite exciting and really nice to be able to launch this topic again. You know, like you said before, and we were talking about, you know, this has been around at least, you know, I remember scrubbing in the 90s and doing laparoscopic, you know, instrumentation. And I'm surprised too that, you know, a lot of the facilities and surgery centers are not doing insulation testing. And the webinar was kind of that kickoff and it went really well. And I really, really hope that people leaving that webinar, whether they had an insulation tester, you know, can go back and look at some key things. And then ones that didn't have that or were not testing, would go back and, shop around for one based on their inventory.
And it's such a small investment to be able to implement this practice in your department every day. And I know there's a lot of things, salespeople come in and they try to light the world on fire to get you to buy, but this is one that you can trust is literally that urgent. But let's set the table by talking about what exactly is an insulated instrument. Why were they manufactured insulated and how are they used? Just so that we get everybody sort of up to speed on what we're talking about.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you really start from the very beginning, you know, insulated instruments are really covered with a non-conducting material. And it's basically to prevent the passage of electricity in areas not needed. And it's really focused and targeted on tissue and funneled into one to two parts of an instrument. So like a forceps would have two parts or tens, and then one instrument laparoscopic would have one point. So that's really what it is. And it's a temporary coating. And like I stressed, you know, with this webinar is it's very delicate and people forget that. It's really a high frequency of electricity current going to the tissue as a means to cut and coagulate during the procedure. And basically, the benefits of it is the ability to have precise cuts and with limited blood loss as you're going along doing that surgery. And it can be used on a wide range of procedures from breast augmentation to, you know, doing robotic surgery, laparoscopic. I used to scrub in the 90s, and back then, wow, the latest and greatest was laparoscopic. Wow, and now it's robotics and other things. But we've come a long way with it. But that's generally just the basic overview of what that is and how it's used.
So, and I mean, kind of along those same lines, one thing that I always like to remind people is that, you know, the first laparoscopic cholecystectomy was done in 1987. And that was the very first one. And so that really wasn't that long ago, and that's completely changed the game for sterile processing. And in some very real ways, we're still trying to play catch up. And it seems like on certain topics like insulation, we seem to be getting left further and further behind because, you know, we're still not even oftentimes inspecting, you know, using the insulation testers when we've already moved on into robotic instruments. And there are so many other places where this can come to really harm a lot of people. So speaking of numbers, can you give us some statistics for how many people are affected by this?
Well, yeah, you know, today, you know, there's over 3 million laparoscopic procedures done annually in the United States, and that's a lot. And worldwide, it's over, you know, like 7.5 million or something like that. And, you know, it ranges from cholecystectomies to bowel resections, appendectomies. But, you know, that also includes, if you think about robotics and other things that, that are now happening, and really, it comes down to like 5.4, 5.5, I believe, with of these operations will have burns, tissue burns. And that comes out to over like 405,000, I think, with patients having tissue burns. And that's a lot. Okay. That's horrendous. And over 192,000 laparoscopic procedures identified just in California and Florida resulted in about 3.6, I think, or 3.5 per 1,000 cases were more likely to have a straight energy burn. And of course, we all know that California and Florida are great for their medical malpractice. So it's scary. As well as every 90 minutes, you're going to have electrical burn or electrical stray. And 67% of surgical burns go unnoticed during the procedure. Because really, when it comes down to the procedure, you only see about 10 or 12% of the screen. And the rest of that, you're not seeing that. So that 67% is burns that go unnoticed. And then 25 of those are patients who suffer from those burns and possibly could die from it. But the FDA last year came out with that warning letter in 2018. And that's where they stated that, you know, the evidence shows that, you know, the patients are injured and that every 90 minutes in the United States, this type of failure will occur. And that's scary.
Well, and what's probably the most stunning about those massive numbers is the general lack of awareness, particularly from the surgeons themselves. I've shared the story before that I was talking to an OR manager, and unbeknownst to me, there was an OBGYN sitting behind me who listened to me basically say the exact statistics that you just said. You know, 67% of the time it's unnoticed during the procedure. And the surgeon immediately perked up and said, you know, there is no way that that is accurate. You know, that is purely a sales pitch. And I said, well, you know, this isn't just me saying it. I've got the numbers in the study right here. What is the general awareness from surgeons in regards to these potential stray energy burns?
From my experience, again, scrubbing in the 90s when laparoscopic instruments were, you know, the latest and greatest, you know, I do recall, and what's sad is that, you know, I go back and think a patient would come in for a laparoscopic procedure of some kind, right? But 3 to 4 days, 5 days later, the same patient was back, but they were back for an exploratory lap. And I remember seeing that here and there, and now thinking back, wow, I bet you anything that was probably because of burns, tissue burns. And we weren't testing back then. I had no idea that even existed. You know, today, you know, I haven't scrubbed in a while, but I would like to hope that surgeons are not looking at, you know, a sales pitch or, you know, these are just numbers and where are you getting these numbers, and really focusing on, you know, whether it's true or not, still going and doing that best practice and having that tested before the procedure. But with the whole turnovers and, you know, getting more for less and such, and just that tight timeline between cases, you know, I've been in facilities where they, you know, we can't do that. We can't do inflation testing because they said it just takes too much time. And it's surgeon driven. You know, they want to just do so many cases a day and such, you know, and have certain block times.
You know, the complications can get out of hand really fast. And I think that
everybody has a story. Everybody has a story. To me, that's overwhelming evidence. The story from my home state of Pennsylvania was a longstanding representative, John Murtha, went in for a routine cholecystectomy, wound up getting readmitted 3 days later, and then passed away. And, you know, all signs point to, I don't know that they ever said that this was definitely the cause, but just how rapidly it progressed, all signs pointed to fecal peritonitis. They likely had stray energy burn, burned a hole through his large intestine. Feces escaped all throughout essentially his abdomen or his perineal cavity. And that's so hard to get control of that statistically one in four people will die, 25%, from fecal peritonitis if that's a complication that happens. And that was very high profile. And, you know, it's important to say that, but also – there's regulatory and legal impact from these insulation failures. Because he was a high profile and long tenured representative in Pennsylvania, this was very well broadcast. That's why I said at the top, I'm just so surprised this isn't second nature, because this stuff has actually hit out there in the public, and we see it a lot more nowadays with issues like this going out into public media. And, but I'd say that wasn't always the case over the last 20 years, but that was a high profile one. And it hasn't quite been a decade, but it's been quite some time since that incident happened.
You know, and when I was getting all the information together to do this presentation for the webinar, I knew of some malpractice cases. And then I started to dive in a little bit because I didn't want to focus. And I want to make sure one of the biggest messages I can give out there today is it's not just laparoscopic. Okay. We're looking at robotics. We're looking at bipolar forceps and bipolar scissors and bipolar cords and cables, anything that's insulated. So I really want to stress that, because when I go to facilities and do audits and I check, they have all these items, but they're barely even checking laparoscopic. So, but as I started going into some malpractice, I found actually Da Vinci robot lawsuits, in regards, like this particular one was in New York. And it said that it was a the Da Vinci robot lawsuit where a 24-year-old girl died following robotics procedure. She died of a small bowel injuries, and claiming that the robot's equipment lacked sufficient insulation. It goes on to say a study in 2011 showing that some forms of insulation failed on the Da Vinci robot as much as four times the rate of conventional surgical equipment. And the cancer center there reported three cases of artery burns resulting from the poor insulation on the robot. You know, and I can go on and read all these different ones that I found, but it's giving the same message that something needs to be done. You know, you see all these figures and numbers, and obviously it's not about the money, but, you know, you lose a life, you lose something. It's just, it's not about the money. I mean, there's one that I read that $2.8 million was awarded for a burn for just general laparoscopic procedure from a medical malpractice case. Another one just talks about the symptoms that usually patients seem to appear or experience normal recovery, which is what I was talking about when I was scrubbing and during the first few days. But however, 3 to 7 days, they have complications like fever and nausea and vomiting. And when they go back in to do exploratory lab to find a cause for that, then it's discovered that they have internal organs that were burned during that procedure. So it's pretty scary, but there's a lot of articles, there's a lot of malpractice things that you can find. A lot of it is unlaparoscopic, but even like you said before, it wasn't really in the public eye, and now it is.
I'm grateful that you were able to put some dollar figures on there, because you know, oftentimes, you know, like you say, it shouldn't be all about money, but nevertheless, you know, sometimes it takes those big dollar amounts to really get people's attention. You know, maybe not the clinicians, but that does sometimes is required to get at the attention of the administrators. You know, so the point is that you've got two huge arrows pointing towards you need to do this. And one is patient safety, because people are actively getting hurt and killed in many cases. And it's also a lot of regulatory and financial pointed to it. So, you know, when both of these things are pointing to do your insulation testing, you know, why wouldn't you do that? I thought it'd be really helpful at this point to discuss what are some of the causes of damage to the insulation.
So the causes of insulation are all over the place. They can happen in every point of basically that instrument. But some of the main causes would be like poor transport, poor handling during the procedure, and in SPD both, because during the procedure as a scrub, you know, you've got to be delicate, and you shouldn't be throwing them on your Mayo stand or your back table. And they're also mixed with metal instruments as well when you're doing that procedure. SPD, depending on how they separate, could be an issue where they're scraping against each other with metal under the insulation. Poor setup when, you know, breaking down the back table and it's all soiled and you're transporting it to decontam and they're all mixed up like pickup sticks, which is not appropriate, and making sure that they're in one direction and not touching, you know, other metal items to, you know, damage that insulation. Insufficient setup and assembly. Again, mixing metal instruments with the laparoscopic, and maybe they don't have like holders or racks or things to separate those type of items. The other thing is poor cleaning, using the wrong tools. Typically when I go to SPDs, you all hear managers, oh, we don't allow copper or metal brushes. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. They're great. They work great. The problem is you can't use them on installation instruments. And that's what happens. The temptation is there when you have something like that. Because, you know, maybe at the other end, you know, the customer end or the OR end, they may not be spraying the instrument or wiping things off. So it's really hard to get that caked on tissue and blood and stuff off that spatula or L hook or whatever it may be. So like when you're cooking and you're not cooking with oil and you're trying to make an egg, you know, what's going to happen? It's going to stick and cook. And how to get it off? Well, you can soak it all you want, but you may be using some aggressive sponge to get it off. So again, you're starting to see, you know, SPDs not have the metal brushes, but that could be another area of concern to where they're taking off the insulation itself at that distal tip.
You just unpacked some really key points all in there. And I just want to go back and emphasize a couple of things. One thing you said was the point of use cleaning and talking about keeping debris free of the instrument. And, you know, that's AMI, that's AST, that's AORN, that's CDC, that's everywhere. And it's a really hot topic and the Joint Commission is focusing on it right now. So point of use cleaning really helps maintain sort of these instruments. And then you talked about metal brushes. So critical that people understand, you're right, metal brushes cannot be used on coating, but I've seen a lot of places just eliminate metal brushes from the inventory altogether because they're having a hard time getting that messaging correct with the frontline staff, because once they've had damage to instruments like this, all of a sudden they get scared and they say, we've got to get rid of these, which I understand why they might react that way. But at the same time, if the brushes are used properly, they're totally fine on stainless steel. And that's a big industry misconception that comes about from this conversation. And I want to add one other, the third point, but you may want to add on the metal brushes, but you used the best analogy there is. You talked about a frying pan and cooking an egg. And what a lot of people don't realize on these bipolars is many of them, including the Silver Glide, have a Teflon coating, which is exactly what's on the bottom of the frying pan to make it, quote unquote, non-stick. Right. And so I have definitely heard about people using like an abrasive tool. I'll just leave it general, but the Teflon can get scraped off and then you're back to the worst problem. What happens when you use a Brillo pad on a nonstick pan? It kills it. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on the metal brushes or you wanted to add to that or the Teflon point.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're damaging, it's basically used for something that's metal. And yes, the tip may be metal or Teflon, but you're taking off a layer that needs to be there. And, you know, it's, again, it's just, it's ruining the device and it's definitely going to cause some harm to a patient, not just with burns possibly, but also debris or pieces of that insulation falling into the patient as well. The other thing I want to add is I had went to ISHM, the inference ISHM conference not too long ago, and I was walking around. I love to walk around in the vendor exhibit. I think it's amazing, all the innovation that you see out there. And one vendor actually had a sterile type lube that could be used during the procedure, right before the procedure, that could be put on the spatulas and L-hooks and other things that are going to be used for cautery, to where it won't stick to it. Sort of like what I talked about with the egg in using oil. I thought that was a great tool to use. So it I don't know how long it's been out, but that was new to me. So that's something else that's, you know, out there to help with not using the metal brushes or to be able to use a regular brush to get that bioburden off.
So a lot of the things that you pointed out are things that happen, you know, up to that point of inspection. But is there anything that can help prevent insulation damage happening once the instrument set is packaged up and put into the autoclave? Because obviously we're talking about testing it at, you know, the prep and pack station, but there's still some pretty significant things that can go wrong between you're done at the prep and pack station and it's used in the surgical case.
Yeah. So, you know, after the testing is done, you want to make sure that you're very delicate with the instrumentation. What I see and what I speak to a lot is I see everybody handling these, you know, instruments so carefully, you know, bipolar forceps or whatever. And then right when the person has it at prep and pack, they dump the set or they tangle up all the laparoscopic instruments, or after they're done testing everything, they're very rough with those devices and then they put them in very fast or whatever it may be. So they're already damaging the instrument after they've tested it and it passed, you know. So, you know, really the assembly is so important of making sure that these are fixed in and not rolling around and banging against each other. And they're definitely separated from, you know, your metal instrumentation, because laparoscopic sets in general are going to have a mixture, right? They're going to have metal instruments like towel clips and, you know, mayos and other things and needle holders to basically take out something or to, you know, suture up. So it's not a whole lot of metal instruments, but it's enough to do some damage. And also after that, handling the set and being careful, just like any other set, you know, not being rough with it and not tossing it or, you know, and being rough with that package. And then, of course, on the other end, once it's sterilized and just cooled and it's put away, again, being careful with those trays, especially when they're pulled for case carts for the procedures. I've seen everybody be treated like a baby, right? Treated like a baby, you know, not toss the baby, not drop the baby, not meaning to. And then they're very rough when they're putting it on case carts, or rough when they're opening and just slamming things down. So you're right. I mean, things could happen after that as well.
So the next step is, especially for the departments out there that don't even have an insulation tester, is choosing the right one. And I gotta think, you had alluded to this earlier and I didn't want to jump on it right then, but many places that are doing insulation testing are simply limiting it to laparoscopic instruments and not including the bipolars, and not every tester out there is capable of testing bipolar forceps, et cetera. So maybe that's a consideration, but I'm sure there's other additional considerations when choosing an insulation tester.
Yeah. So what I tell people is insulation testers are sort of like this. The range is going to be, would you like a Toyota or would you like a Tesla? So the ranges in prices can be pretty dramatic, even to the point where they're free, you know, and really the price should not, you know, basically sacrifice quality. You really need to pick an insulation tester that's going to fit the inventory you have. For an example, if you just do laparoscopic, you have no other instrumentation but laparoscopic, then you could choose a tester that just caters to that. And sorry to say, a lot of them do cater to laparoscopic. So you could be misled not knowing that, you know what, I have robotics, I have bipolar scissors. How do I do that? To find out the accessories that come with that insulation tester may not have it, or they have it, but it's just cumbersome. It's not user-friendly. And when something's not user-friendly in SPD, what happens? You end up not having non-compliance. So again, when you're shopping, things to consider too is some insulation units you can't just buy. You have to either go with that vendor's repair service and then they provide a free insulation tester. I do see that. I see some given free if you use a repair service, you know, either fully or just a little bit. Ones that I see out there too range in prices. But again, you'll see the Toyota to the Tesla. Obviously, the Tesla versions are going to have more accessories. They're easier to use. They can actually be used different ways, which is great. So that's kind of what you're looking for. But really, you need to start with your inventory. What insulated instruments am I going to test, and what is going to meet that need?
That's fantastic. So you kind of alluded to it, but kind of following along that same line of, you know, if it's too complex, it's not going to get done. I remember at one of the first facilities I was a technician at, the insulation tester that we had would randomly shock us sometimes. This was an old model that needed to be replaced, you know, so this is not normal by any means. But the fact that there was this other complication going on made it difficult to, comply consistently. And so I wondered if, you have any suggestions on how to hardwire that consistent compliance into the front lines?
That's a really good question. I would love to answer that. So, as you guys know, we travel a lot, with speaking engagements, but we travel a lot and we go to SPDs across the country in hospitals and surgery centers and doing audits. And what I find, and it's very consistent, is you don't have enough insulation testers to meet the need of the department and the workstations and the staff. So what I mean is, they'll have one insulation tester and they'll have 6 to 8 workstations. And then I'll ask, well, how many laparoscopic procedures do you do a day? How many sets do you have? And they'll say, we have 20 or 50. We do about, 6 or 8 a day. And I'm thinking, well, do you guys fight over the tester or what goes on? And, it's hard when you have you can share all you want, but if you work in SPD today, it's pretty fast paced. Okay. I don't have time to be waiting and work on another set possibly, but my advice is to get more. And yes, they can be expensive. And the ultimate goal is to have one per workstation because you'll get more compliance. But if you don't, you need to have at least 2 and 2 that are mobile, meaning it's on a cart or maybe an old crash cart or something to where it can be moved to those workstations, but at least minimum 2, but really preferably having them on each workstation. And then finding obviously the right tester to be able to meet that inventory, like we talked about with those accessories.
So Sharon, what does the industry tell us in terms of recommendations and guidelines? How can we emphasize the need for this in our departments, especially when maybe we don't have an insulation tester? We obviously have to make a case for it. What can we do in terms of supporting our listeners to getting this into place?
Well, the first thing you want to look at is your instructions for use, your IFUs for your devices. And a lot of your devices that are insulated do say how to check it, what to look for, and what to use. And some do say actually in their IFUs to use an insulation tester of some sort. So that would be the first thing. AMI, which is our Bible and SPD, SD79 has no specific information on insulated items, but do recommend obviously visual inspection for defects of all instrumentation. ARN, which is your Association of Operating Room Nurses, does go into more detail with insulated devices should be visually examined and tested using equipment designed to detect insulation failures. Another good document is AST, which your Association for Surgical Technologists. They go into very much detail with this. And basically it says insulated instruments and electrodes should be inspected in the central supply department prior to sterilizing. And then it goes on to say to follow these 5 steps. Some of the key steps that I thought were important is that this one says D, an insulation scanner should be used to detect the release of stray electrical energy along the length of the instrument itself. So those right now are really what is out there to test your insulated devices.
So I guess the final question we have as we get ready to wrap up the interview, Sharon, is what about documentation? How do we show that we're doing this? Because the recommendation is to do it after every single procedure when you're getting this equipment ready to be sterilized and go back up for another case. So what are some ways to, and I'm going to put this in quotes, but how do we document that this is something that we're doing?
So that is another good question. With the medical malpractices I was reading, and if you're in California and Florida, you definitely need to be doing some documentation. But you're right, you need to document this because in a court of law, they're going to look at if it wasn't documented, it didn't happen. And they're going to go back to those records. And the best thing to do with that is to, if you don't have an instrument tracking system, obviously if you have an instrument tracking system, you can do so much with that and per set, and you can, you know, document in there that you've done some type of testing on each instrument and it passed, it failed, it had an action to it. But if you don't have an instrument tracking system, you know, coming up with an Excel spreadsheet that says, you know, this set number 12, because you would label your trays, you know, making sure the instruments don't interchange every step of the way, pass and fail. And if there was any actions with that, meaning if it failed, what did you do about it? Did you replace it with a backup? Did you send it out for repair and such? But, you know, documentation is very much key in this, because they are going to go back. If there was something that happened, they're going to go back to that and they're going to look for that particular set, that particular day, look at the serialization load and go all the way to the root cause and say, was this tray checked? So, you know, you're absolutely right. It does definitely need to be documented.
This is such an important topic, and the energy that you brought to the show, fantastic. I really think you're going to make an impression and hopefully make a difference and really make sure that everybody is doing this and understands how critical this practice is every single day in your departments out there. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I wish we had more time to talk more into detail, but thank you so much again for having me on the show. Thank you.
Well, we can definitely have you on again in a future episode. You did an amazing job. So be on the lookout for another invitation.
All right, will do.
That was Sharon Rojo, SPD Educational Coordinator for Healthmark Industries. I love the title for this one. I know I said it already, but the shock treatment. Seriously, I feel like we need to shock people into going out and getting one of these insulation testers and implementing proper practice tomorrow, not just on lap instruments, but on all of the electrosurgical equipment that we discussed with Sharon today, Mike.
You know, one thing we've talked about repeatedly is that often isn't enough research done in the field to kind of prove the value of sterile processing technicians. We all know they're valuable. We've lived that world, you know, but to have the numbers and the research to back it up. What's different about this topic is we've already got the research. We already know the numbers, and they all point towards we have to be doing this to protect patients' lives. There really just is flat out no excuse to not be testing every single insulated instrument every single time. We know that what we do or what we choose not to do can have a dramatic effect on people's lives. So get out there and start doing it.
Yeah, this one's a big one, and the consequences can be pretty grave, as you said. So that's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. Simply search for Beyond Clean Podcast. We'd appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important to the show. And if you have any topics that you'd like us to cover on a future episode, or if you'd like to share a picture anonymously on our Instagram page, just send an email to info@beyondclean.net. On behalf of Hank, Mike, Bob, and myself, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.